Hello and welcome to another edition of The View From Here. I'm your co-host, Jeff Milchin.
Along with Steve Kirkhoff.
And today we're going to be talking about media and elections, specifically some of the issues around media coverage of 2020 elections, which, of course, up till this point have consisted primarily of the Democratic primaries, but looking forward also to the general election, some of the concerns around what we're hearing in the corporate media, framing of issues, an analysis of some of the concerns that many people have had about the coverage up to this point. So to start off with, let's talk a little bit about the general tone of media coverage and the idea of presenting the election race as kind of a horse race coverage rather than talking about the issues and informing listeners, readers, viewers about the candidates' issue positions as a longtime concern, but one that seems to be getting worse, if anything, and not better.
Absolutely. I mean, the horse race as a format for reporting on elections is far more innocuous than what we're getting treated to in this cycle. You know, in races in the past, I think the notion that Trump is being strategic in saying this and someone is taking a wise tactic by doing the other thing and positioning him or herself in such a way as to gain a strategic edge in whatever primary race it might be. That's seemingly innocent compared to what we're seeing today, because instead of just doing that bland kind of who's ahead and who's being smart about how they garner votes, what we're getting is essentially an all-out attack on the front runner on the Democratic side, that being Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, one of the problems too that I see, at this point, we're recording on March 1st, the day after the South Carolina primary. So up to this point, there have been four primaries out of, you know, at this point, if we were playing a basketball game, we might have played the first 2 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. And yet the media is just constantly making predictions about who's viable, who's not, who's out of the game after the first 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's a frustrating thing because it really impedes the opportunity for people to, I think, gain a better understanding of the issues and make informed choices. Right now, we're in a spot where Senator Bernie Sanders needs 1,935 more delegates to win. And Senator Elizabeth Warren needs 1,983 more delegates to win. And yet, you know, one is portrayed as one of two options by a lot of people at this point, along with Joe Biden, while Warren has basically been erased from the media coverage to a large degree for the past several days, at least. You know, do we have the ability to impact that in any way? What can we do if we're, you know, consuming this media coming from national sources that's presenting in this way? Obviously, each person has the individual ability to make choices about where they get their information, but the societal impact is still going to be huge no matter what we decide individually. Mm-hmm. Many thoughts around...
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that the media shapes our awareness and they shape our sort of our consciousness of what is at stake. And if they're constantly framing it around Bernie as a menace, Bernie as a socialist, name-calling, sort of the ad hominem attacks, taking the word socialism, using it as a bullet and aiming it at Bernie as a way to bring him down, the media is not merely reporting. That goes far beyond the horse race, you know, what I was saying just a second ago. That goes into a serious attempt to undermine the legitimacy of a candidate through the language that is being used to describe his status.
Right. And that certainly is going on, you know, and I'm saying this, we're not going to be talking about our individual political choices in terms of preferred politicians, but I will say I'm not necessarily someone who's backing Sanders, but I nevertheless have been astounded by the degree to which the corporate media is united against him and stacking the deck. And what's been illuminating, in a sense, is how the mask has come off at outlets like MSNBC, which are nominally viewed as progressive, but which have brought out one person after another attacking Sanders. Bernie Sanders and the coronavirus, can either of them be stopped?
I've seen him.
And meanwhile, while our current president is actively aiding and abetting known dictators, known human rights abusers, and autocrats around the world, we have continual coverage about what Bernie Sanders said about being a little too sympathetic towards Fidel Castro about 50 years ago.
Yeah, well, you know, what's unsettling to me, too, is that those kinds, that use of a buzzword, say socialism or Nazi or coronavirus, to bring down someone, to tarnish someone's reputation, apart from being what we call a logical fallacy, something as a writing instructor at MSU I teach my students to avoid. I mean, apart from that, you can only be successful at that sort of verbal warfare if you believe that you're working in an environment of relative cultural amnesia regarding the content of politics, particularly leftist politics. You know, it's simplistic, and it seems to bank on this notion that no one out there really knows. No one out there still follows what would be a political agenda to any degree of detail. So we can safely operate free of content and simply lob these incendiary verbal bombs at people we don't like. And yet, they would only be launching these bombs if they had entrenched interest that they thought that they were defending and they thought were under attack by Bernie Sanders. So there is a whole world of content, but it's a little bit like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. We're only seeing what's happening on the curtain. We're seeing the ripples in the curtain. We're seeing the whatever is being displayed up on the screen. And they being the mainstream media, are for a large part expecting us to have no notion that there's a better way to talk about these things and that we're captive and that that this strategy could work. And I think there is some concern on my part that it actually could work, that enough fear-mongering can be successful in turning people away from Bernie Sanders. And whether or not you are a proponent or in favor of Bernie Sanders, I think it's an objective truth that he is being undermined at every opportunity.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, certainly there's that attempt to. There's the constant name-calling. There's a lot of the red-baiting going on. But it seems almost like Sanders has reached a point that Trump did in the previous election cycle where there's almost now this immunity. It's gotten so out of hand that people just tune it out completely because you haven't seen the attacks really taking a whole lot of effect on him up to at least to any visible degree over the past week or two.
And that will hopefully be true. Because it's a scurrilous, you know, way to use your power. You know, if you own media, you basically own this opportunity to influence people's cultural awareness and political awareness of what's happening around them and how empowered or disempowered they are to do things about it. So hopefully you're right and people can see through it and they will not be swayed by it. I'm not so sure. Maybe a huge difference maker is the sort of populism of Donald Trump, in which his scaremongering is designed to sort of motivate his base to target other people and hold them up as the enemy and then militate against them. So militate against immigrants, militate against progressive liberals, militate against the socialists. I don't see Bernie doing that so much. I think Bernie is more of an old school leftist. He's basically saying that we need to have fairness in taxation. We need to support labor in our country. We need to have policies that are going to provide health care to people who don't have it, which is 80 plus million Americans. So when Bernie talks, it's bread and butter issues. He's good old fashioned leftist Democrat politician. And the kind of thing that you and I grew up in seeing and hearing about for the most part until the advent of the 1990s and the sort of co-opting of what were bread and butter Democratic issues. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, does Bernie have a way to galvanize his support even in the face of this sort of barrage of attacks? You're saying that maybe the bullets are just falling and they're not actually hitting. I hope you're right.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. You know, it's hard to say, but just based on looking at what's going on in the poll numbers, you see, it doesn't seem that that's having an obvious impact. I mean, I think there's a sense in which when you see the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post and MSNBC and NBC and CBS all attacking someone, you start wondering, why are all these corporate media outlets attacking this one person? What are they so afraid of? Mm-hmm. You know, I think if Senator Warren were to take the lead tomorrow, I think all of those attacks would pretty much occur at the same level of vociferousness mm-hmm. and simply be directed at her.
Being and probably the same words, probably socialist.
A lot of, right? For sure. You know, there seem to be clearly two people that corporate powers are not interested in seeing in office in this election cycle, and then the rest of them are varying levels of acceptability. Without getting too focused on an individual candidate, there seems to be this overwhelming tendency to try to narrow it down to a two-horse race as quickly as possible. And a week ago, the horse might have been Michael Bloomberg running alongside Sanders. This week, it's Joe Biden. But what's behind that process? Any thoughts about...
I think it's more manageable for those people who are sort of running the information system. It's more manageable. It's more sort of photogenic to have two people. It's easier to conceptualize. It simplifies the race. And unfortunately, it will lead to oversimplifications. But it could give an opportunity to actually sort of dig into differences on issues. That mm-hmm. actually might be one positive effect of it, is that we can now focus. Right. Although Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are very close to each other ideologically, there are big differences between those two and Joe Biden.
Right.
But yeah, I think the media likes it. Mano a mano, it's kind of fun. It's more dramatic in a way.
Right. And so relating to this, I know you've seen some of the debates, and I've watched a few of the Democratic primary debates, ranging from fairly well done to like being hit.
Just a free for all.
To something like being hit in the face with a hammer repeatedly. Yeah. That would probably best describe the few minutes of the last debate I saw in South Carolina, where not only were the questions delivered from an explicitly corporate anti-democratic point of view, but there was no apparent attempt to moderate the debate in any way. One of the interesting things in the Charleston, South Carolina debate was it was the first debate at which you actually heard an audience cheering for Michael Bloomberg or booing for any of the progressive candidates. And it was interesting to find out later on, when actually had to be a sponsor, there were no tickets given out like at many debates. The starting price was $1,750 to be a Democratic National Committee official sponsor for one of the local sponsors and have a chance at getting a ticket to the debate. So mm-hmm. we essentially had a debate full of mm-hmm. people who were probably millionaires or close to it, or people brought along at their invitation. So another aspect of kind of the media framing was...
Yeah, and this notion that the people in the audience were not rank-and-file citizens that just stood in line and were able to get into the auditorium, but were sponsors whose pockets were deep enough to afford nearly $2,000 for the attendance. That's good to know, but how many people know it? One of the problems of having a media that can sort of bank on cultural amnesia regarding the depth of political issues is that, yeah, maybe people will see through the media because all they hear is the condemnation, all they hear is the screech, they just hear the cry, they hear the laments about who the front runner is, they hear the tossing around of these buzzwords to attack the person instead of talk about the ideas. And maybe that's going to have a paradoxical effect and people will actually be more attracted to that person who's being attacked. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, on what basis? What is the content of their affiliation with that person, other than if the media doesn't like him, he must be good, or she must be good if they're attacking her? That's a flimsy basis to be making decisions about candidates on. And it's also a testament to how flimsy is our cultural knowledge of political ideas. And I feel that that's the frightening part to me, is whether or not there is a touching base with the fundamental ideas that candidates stand for, as opposed to just tuning the whole thing out. I mean, one of the things that this strategy on the part of the mainstream media could result in is massive indifference on the part of people who would otherwise participate. And you could see low turnout numbers. And I do believe that even though you said so far we're still in the first minutes of the first quarter of a four-quarter basketball game, turnout so far has been lower than what Bernie claims he needs in order to defeat Trump. So people are not exactly, except for maybe South Carolina, they had a nice turnout, right? But I think in the previous three, it was fairly mediocre, wasn't it?
I believe so. I haven't followed the data closely, but it's kind of a tough comparison because last time around, there clearly were two candidates by this point who had a chance, real chance of winning, if I remember correctly, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. In this case, you have a great many candidates who have, at least up to this point, have been viable candidates. So a lot of people may not necessarily care whether, if they're a progressive, whether it's Sanders or Warren as the nominee, or less passionately, or they may not care that much about whether it's any one of the centrist candidates, whether it's Buttigieg or Klobuchar or mm-hmm. Biden or mm-hmm. many others. Mm-hmm. So I think it's tough to draw an apples-to-apples comparison in that mm-hmm. regard when you had a clear A-B choice last time around, and it's a much murkier choice at this point in the 2020 primaries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe it's because Joe Biden stammers so much that no one really knows what he stands for. He's not able to articulate his positions very well, but I would say that he's like on the libertarian side of the Democratic Party. And
libertarian?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would never in a million years have thought of Joe Biden as a libertarian. What brings that?
Well, I think he's much more about globalized trade, for example, without the restrictions that somebody like Bernie Sanders would advocate. I don't know that he is has a record of sort of standing by unions and by standing by labor the way that Bernie claims he wants to. He's certainly not in favor of Medicare for all and has badgered Bernie on that point sort of endlessly for some time. And regarding how these programs are to be paid for, Bernie's answer is always we're going to tax the wealthiest in our nation. And I think that makes Joe Biden blanch. And so I would call him a conservative Democrat. I mean, I don't know how else to call it. And so it's a pretty stark choice. You have Bernie and Elizabeth Warren on one side and then Joe Biden on the other. There's a big breach between.
Oh, yeah. It's not something I would consider. Yeah, you called Joe Biden libertarian and then conservative Democrat, which to me are two dramatically different things. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about free trade, I mean, despite the big differences between the two dominant political parties at this point, trade is one where there's very little disagreement, frankly. Bipartisan consensus overall that we should continue to have enormously powerful patents that extend beyond human lifespans, that accrue to corporations, that prevent free market competition for things like pharmaceuticals being probably the most impactful one in society. While certainly there are some voices out there calling for taking public research, which is behind many of the most important, medically important drugs in the world, and making them actually publicly produced products at much lower prices, you certainly don't find that opinion in the mainstream of either party challenging the idea that research should be mm-hmm. privatized and then sold back to the public rather than kept as a public asset. Mm-hmm. So when we're you were talking earlier about socialist argument being brought into the debate by many of the media outlets. It's another one where it feels to me like there's the public is being really poorly served by that debate. Because when you look at the United States of America, we have socialized roads, we have socialized police, socialized fire, airports, and internet, and countless, or at least the development of it, now it's been privatized. Another example where, publicly funded research had created the asset, and now it's been turned into a private profit generator. We're looking at, so we have a whole lot of elements of socialism in the United States. We also have capitalist elements. And rather than a bright line between one and the other, we have a spectrum where the United States is in one spot, Canada might be one inch to the left towards socialism, Denmark might be a few inches to the left, and I don't know who might be to the right on the more pure capitalist model, but this idea that one person is a capitalist and the other is a socialist doesn't seem to bear much of a resemblance to reality.
Mm-hmm. But when you take a single issue and try to examine it by how capitalistic and how socialistic is, let's say, healthcare, and the provision of healthcare in the United States of America is largely a capitalistic endeavor, right? It's supported by policies of our government, which maintain sort of monopoly control on the part of pharmaceuticals in terms of pricing, right? Mm-hmm. And pricing of all different kinds of things, including drugs, supplies in hospitals, mm-hmm. procedures that are done. We have a marketplace which has essentially run amok, right? And one could argue that's a capitalistic approach to the provision of healthcare. And ironically, it's horribly inefficient, it's very expensive, and it underperforms in terms of covering people's health adequately, keeping our population healthy, and keeping costs down to individuals. So as a result, we have, like, what is it, 1 in 4 Americans have no insurance. And so I think the Bernie Sanders response to that is because human health shouldn't be covered by insurance, period. And I don't think that Joe Biden says that. Right, so I think that is right there. That's a line of demarcation. Right? We don't necessarily want to abolish insurance companies and the whole notion of insurance, but we might want to in this particular domain because capitalism doesn't seem to be the proper delivery system for healthcare. Right, it should be socialized, and so there's a marked difference between the two. And I guess that's why I pointed that as a bright line.
Yeah, but even there, I mean, as far as I know, Senator Sanders is not advocating for socialized health care. He's advocating for getting rid of private corporate insurance, yeah. But still having privately administered health care by doctors in it for profit with the government negotiating maybe for prices of services as a market.
You can't abolish insurance. People can still go out and buy health insurance if they want to, right?
Sure.
And that's how they can get their health care if they want to in the future, no matter if we have a socialized system or not, right? Medicare for all is the whole notion that you don't have to buy insurance, that you will be covered, that you just walk into a hospital and you are taken care of, and there's no billing, there's no copay.
Right, but all I'm saying is that even Sanders and Warren, to my knowledge, have never suggested having government-administered health care, that they're talking about private physicians providing service, which is a very different model from actual government-employed mm-hmm. Doctors, surgeons, nurses, etc., being the ones who are doing the healthcare provision.
Well, except that in the future, under Medicare for All, they will be billing the government, essentially.
Right.
Right? Yeah.
But it's still a hybrid model. It's mm-hmm. It's not purely capitalistic. It's not purely socialistic. Medicare for All is a hybrid of capitalism and socialism.
Right.
Going back to the point of that debate being fairly unhelpful in terms of, in my opinion, in informing the public, to talk about, well, Elizabeth Warren may call herself a capitalist to the bones while Bernie Sanders says he's a democratic socialist, but in reality, they're talking about slightly different shades of the same issue. And even looking at the most conservative Republicans out there, they're still embracing socialism in many different regards. They're not talking about anything resembling a true capitalist society.
Oh, sure. Yeah. The point that you brought before about patent control and protections for the pharmaceutical industry, those are socialism for corporations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I tend to be much more of an actual free market advocate in many ways than people who call themselves capitalists, because I don't believe that the government should necessarily be in the business of providing protection against competition for corporations when
Absolutely.
It comes to patents and copyrights, unless there is a truly compelling public interest. And even then, competition needs to come sooner, and it needs to be more broad than it currently is allowed to by our government.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And nearly all of these policies, I would say, those that are protectionist of people who have controlling financial interests in one business or another, most of these policies originated at the behest of those corporations themselves. So it's a very protectionist form. And the two candidates who are continually, invoking and weighing in against that overweening corporate control are Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And it's still a three-horse race until maybe after Super Tuesday. But
you're discounting the billionaire, huh? Or billionaires.
I believe so, yeah. I believe so. I mean, Bloomberg doesn't like to talk. I mean, he will speak.
It does seem to be a limitation for a politician.
He doesn't like to answer questions. He doesn't like to have a question directed at him. So
right.
Yeah. That's going to be hard.
It's amazing how uncomfortable you can get with people challenging you, and you're a billionaire and haven't been challenged by anyone for a couple of decades, apparently. So I'm curious, Steve, are you aware of any candidates having actually supported free market competition in the realm of healthcare when it comes to lowering some of the barriers that we have in place to allowing foreign doctors to come and practice in the United States, or lowering barriers to people to get into business doing teeth cleaning and some of the other health services that, you know, in most states they have licensing that says only an actual dentist can clean your teeth, or someone working directly under their supervision. So there are many different ways in which free market competition is prevented, and it's somewhat dubious whether there's a real public interest in that, mm-hmm. or whether it's simply the ability of already relatively wealthy and prosperous people to use government to put up barriers mm-hmm. to competition mm-hmm. that keep their salaries propped up.
I do not know about any policies or any politicians who are in favor of policies that would allow, say, foreign educated doctors to become more numerous in our country. Although I did read a little snippet in an article yesterday on an unrelated topic stating that there were more Ethiopian doctors practicing in the state of Illinois than there are in Ethiopia. Maybe it's a state-by-state basis in which, you know, the threshold that one has to cross over holding a medical degree from another nation is lower. So I don't know if that's state-by-state or how that works.
Yeah, well, there certainly are some federal limitations. I don't know all the details on that, but debate over free trade agreements, that's almost never brought to the forefront, the fact that we have blue-collar workers competing against the lowest-paid workers on the planet in many places, mm-hmm. you know, in developing nations, but yet there are actually very high barriers to competition for highly paid professionals mm-hmm. to prevent Chinese doctors, Indian doctors, and others from coming to practice in the United States.
I guess it's who's doing the advocacy, because I know that a lot of the tech giants, Amazon and Apple and Microsoft, were lobbying hard to get computer designers and engineers to be able to work in the United States under multi-year visas. And so they were trying to find ways to soften those restrictions so that they could bring in, presumably, people who were not used to higher wages to work in different facilities here in the United States.
Yeah, well, that's a very different power dynamic, mm-hmm. I would say, you know, because when you're looking at doctors and dentists, surgeons, for example, they are the ones with the power, with the money. When you're looking at the tech professionals, it's the employing corporations, it's the Apple, it's the Amazon with the power, not the individual tech workers, even though their workers may be pretty highly paid compared to the rest of us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Take a minute to remind everyone you're listening to KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman.
The darling of the Gallatin Valley.
You're listening to The View from Here with Jeff Milchen and Steve Kirchhoff. And you also can stream any of the KGVM broadcasting at kgvm.org.
Where to next, Jeff, in our survey of mainstream media coverage of presidential politics?
Well, curious, since you said you've been following the primaries up to this point, what do you think of the treatment of the female candidates in the press and on the debate stage up to this point? We had Kamala Harris, who's since dropped out of the race, Senator from California, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Amy Klobuchar. What do you feel like treatment of the women compared to the men has been?
That's a fair question that I don't know that I have a thoughtful answer to. I think Klobuchar was under some scrutiny after it was revealed that she had something of a tic because her bangs were twitching because of this involuntary motion that she had, and so she did something with a stylist to try to remove that. Because she's sharp as can be, she's a highly intelligent and very strong speaker, but there was a little bit of a focus on her appearance at that moment, as if that could undermine her legitimacy as a candidate. I'm not sure how to parse out that, as if that's a sexist comment, or if, you know, a man with a stutter or a stammer might have been undermined for his inability to communicate adequately.
A related question, we now have in the Democratic primaries an all-white candidate field, mm-hmm. after several candidates who many consider to be very strong, certainly very well-qualified candidates at the outset. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, Senator Kamala Harris of California, mm-hmm. Julian Castro of Texas. Mm-hmm. None of them ever got off the ground in terms of...
It's difficult in this day and age because not everyone, but particularly Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and numerous other Democratic candidates have pointed out the overwhelming influence of dollars to start your political machine. And if you want to have outreach in states that are early primary states, for example, then you need to get people in offices, you need to get people going door to door, you need to be knocking on doors, meeting residents, you need to be able to have your website and maintain it, have the mail outs, the flyers. You
sure.
need to have a tremendous amount of personnel that all takes money.
But does that explain why Senator Klobuchar, for example, is still in the race, and Pete Buttigieg is still in the race, whereas those candidates, you know, who were into overgeneralized, perhaps in the moderate to slightly progressive realm of the Democratic primary?
Are you trying to suggest that the progressives fell out first?
No, since all of those candidates might be considered in the somewhat center of the party, yet none of the candidates of color made it through to as far as the second primary, I believe. Mm-hmm. What, is there anything
Do you
behind
think that,
that
there's a race component, that the American electorate is not ready for an Hispanic male or for a black female?
I'm not sure about that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a question in my mind. Does that say something, or was it just the individual characteristics of those candidates not standing out enough from the crowd in a very crowded field?
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of this, I think, is guesswork. I don't know what the refined data set would be that we could carefully analyze to come up with an answer to whether or not it was misogyny that was the ultimate undoing of Hillary Clinton in 2016. Is America a country that will elect a black man but will not elect a white woman because we're misogynistic? I mean, you can say that. But what is your support for that, other than just your feeling of living in this culture, your sense of the
right.
prevalent attitudes
right.
that you confront in your day-to-day life?
Well, to me, it's actually rather amazing that people could be asking Senators Warren and Klobuchar, is a woman electable? I mean, in our last race, we had former Senator Hillary Clinton running for office, who did not run a particularly strong campaign in many regards. Certainly she had ample qualifications, but there were a lot of campaign missteps. There were a lot of things working against her in terms of timing of news and media. Mm-hmm. And yet she still won the election by 3 million popular votes.
Mm-hmm. So,
to question whether or not a woman mm-hmm. can win when in the very last election cycle...
No, I think that's a convincing answer, right?
Yeah.
The convincing answer is that she outdid Donald Trump in terms of the popular vote by 3 million, which is the population of many states, right? I mean, that's three times the population of the state of Montana where we are today. So maybe your suggestion is that the very asking of the question, can a woman win, is in itself sort of a vehicle of misogyny in a way, right?
I would absolutely say that.
Right. So it still has clinging to it this kind of a notion of a sexist sort of denigration of the qualities of femaleness itself, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And since we did elect a black president with Barack Obama, no one can say, is a black man electable anymore? But that doesn't convince me that there's still not a lot of kind of attitude coming out in terms of, especially when it comes to the media and how
mm-hmm.
candidates are portrayed in the debates and the questions asked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, some of these things are, they're hard to assess, like people's attitudes toward Joe Biden, for example. So black voters in South Carolina were very favorably disposed to Joe Biden. Joe Biden was Obama's vice president. Mm-hmm. Is that because when they behold Joe Biden, they see the guy who was with Obama? He's like the only white man they've ever seen who's taken an order from a black man. You know what I mean? I don't know. We can make suppositions about why people have this, you know, why black voters have a fondness for Joe Biden. Do they really believe that Joe Biden's going to deliver more for them because of his past association with Obama than Bernie or Elizabeth Warren will provide for them? You know, so much of politics is affiliations that people start to have at a very young age. You know, by the time you've voted in your first presidential election, a vast majority of voters never change their affiliation. So if you voted for the very first time you ever voted for a president, it was for a Democrat, the likelihood that you'll ever cross over and vote for a Republican is like 1 in 8. So people get their political stripes etched onto them at a young age, and they seldom budge from them. If you go to church and your pastor starts saying things that are too liberal for you, you will change churches. You know, politics run even deeper sometimes than religious affiliations. You might really love your pastor. You might think he's a great guy, but he starts talking about socialistic policies. You're out the door. You're going to find somebody that's a little more centrist, you know? So deeply embedded attitudes do show up. How you can gauge them, it takes some sensitive sort of measurements of people's attitudes. Good exit polling. I suppose we could get at these questions. You know, they're probably not mysteries, but I don't know. I don't have ready answers to some of the questions that you're asking about voter attitudes.
Right. Circling back to the media coverage issue, do you have conversations with your students at all about politics outside of the classroom?
Not typically, no. Sometimes I do with a few, but in general, I'm a writing instructor, and I sort of keep the focus on that. But I have asked them to read certain documents, like the Green New Deal, that non-binding resolution that was put before. Was it the House it was put before? It went somewhere. I can't remember which House it went to. Is if it went to the House or if it went to the Senate? But you know, it's that. Green New Deal is typically associated with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and I'm not sure she's the author of it, but she's definitely a co-sponsor of it. And so I asked them to read that document, and it's a very ambitious set of sort of objectives that some people would love to see accomplished in our nation. That is a retooling of our energy systems to a green, sustainable future, a massive hiring of people to do public works projects like was done back in FDR with the Works Projects Association and other kinds of programs of that. So it harkens back to the New Deal, but it's got the green part in it. So I would ask students to read that and give me their careful analysis of, you know, whether they thought it was feasible. And not only did they think it was feasible, they thought it was necessary and should have been done a long time ago. And that is just a cross-section of your average Montana State University student. I've done that in writing courses, and I've done that in political science courses. And some people believe that that's a wacko idea, right? But I feel that the younger generation is, while I don't find a lot of them to be fired up about politics, I find them to be pretty open to some of these so-called socialist ideas that are being put out there. If the socialist ideas, if these programs could get a careful, more sustained hearing before they're just labeled and scuttled by the media as untenable or as extreme, we could be doing ourselves a huge favor. And that's my major problem with the mainstream media. So I don't care about your bias, but can you give me some content that I saw that I can actually talk to you about it? This veiling of the entrenched interests behind buzzwords like socialist and extremist and the name calling of the coronavirus and Hitler just advances only the hidden agenda, which you and I both believe is not hidden. But for the most part, I don't think that people are connecting all these dots.
Right. So it's interesting, you know, looking at through their youth lens, to me, it seems like when you use the scare word of socialism, young people associate that with things like Denmark or Scandinavia or Holland or mm-hmm. other Western European nations or Canada, where they have Medicare for all and other, you know, somewhat higher taxes, but also much greater benefits in terms of support services and health protection. And when people from older generations hear it, they might think first of Castro or
name your
communist nations.
Yeah, name your leftist autocrat, right?
It kind of triggers a very different lens based mm-hmm. on generations. And I think that may be part of why it's losing its power as a scare word. And what are your thoughts around that?
I think that is possible. I think that's quite possible because I think there's just been a gap in people's education. That's one thing I've also noticed about my students is that they're eager to learn and they soak up knowledge and information very readily, provided that you give it to them in a way that can stimulates them. But when they come to Montana State University as freshmen, I find that they're woefully undertrained. I mean, I teach writing, so their writing skills are way behind where they should be. They're basically at a freshman level of high school when I get them. Now, they get a lot better because I see them again as they mature and see them as juniors and seniors, and the difference is marked and profound, and they really do learn a lot. And that's my whole point, is that what are they doing? And I feel like there's been a gigantic slippage in American public education, because maybe the reason that they don't have these negative associations is just that they're not getting a lot of exposure to ideas in general. Right. And so there's a vacancy is what I'm seeing there. It's not even a sympathy for socialism. Maybe there could be a little bit of that because they think of Sweden as socialism. Mm-hmm. And how bad are the Swedes? They're really nice. They have funny sounding voices, you know. So maybe you're right. And that's how they have it has a more benign sort of connotation for young people. My hunch is that it just has an empty connotation because there's just not a lot of content there.
Well, that's depressing.
Well, I don't know if it is depressing.
I was thinking a little more positively that, you know, that the connotation brings up these societies that may mm-hmm. have a larger role for government, but mm-hmm. but still have an extremely high level of personal freedom rather than conjuring up the ideas of communist nations of, you know, mm-hmm. 1960s Russia, for example, or Soviet Union.
But I think our information systems, is particularly the mainstream information systems, the lettered networks and, you know, even more egregiously, the cable news networks, they're just so poor in content. It's just screeching and howling. And also an inattentiveness to each other, right? A lot of talking over. So I feel like our information environment is very, very poor, to say the least.
Right. Oh, no argument there. And you know, beyond the specific critiques we've talked about, let's look at cable news specifically for a minute. You know, on any given night, it seems like there is only one thing happening in the world. You know, mm-hmm. the night of any primary election, it's all about that primary election. And, mm-hmm. and you can literally, unfortunately, I've done it a couple of times, watch for a few hours, and that's all they will talk about. And then another night, it may be 100% coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And it's just continual reactiveness to whatever mm-hmm. is coming in, and largely, in many cases, driven by whatever Donald Trump tweeted on that given day. Mm-hmm. But with an almost universal abstinence of bringing on people who are not elected officials, who are not famous, but who are working to create a better world in many ways, and you know, through nonprofit organizations, through community organizing, those people are almost never given a voice on those cable TV networks, and certainly to a larger degree, very little in the mainstream media overall. I'm continually flummoxed at how do we change that? Of course, normally on this show, we're trying to do our part. Mm-hmm. This is the first show we've done where we haven't been bringing on someone else in mm-hmm. the community as a guest. But how do we change that?
Well, so much of life in our, I guess you can call it democratic society, so much of life in Western democracies, in Western Europe, in North America, Canada, etc., is really kind of a gentleman's agreement, a gentle person's agreement, that we agree to play by certain rules. And one of the rules is that we're going to seek the truth. and that we're both devoted to it. And we might have, you know, decidedly different personal backgrounds and histories, and we came from families that were extremely conservative, highly religious, totally agnostic, scientific materialist, very leftist, whatever it might be. That's what we all bring to conversations. It's not a matter of bludgeoning each other over the head. What we're supposed to be doing with each other when we engage in discourse is trying to find a truth, assuming that the truth is a difficult sort of hybrid, that truth is not the sort of the property of a particular ideology. You might feel that one particular brand of politics better suits human needs, and that's something that you bring to the conversation. But so much of the sort of gentle person's rules have been discarded. They've been scuttled, right? In our mainstream media environments in particular, you see it all the time, that a polite conversation starts with a question. And there's, let's say, two interlocutors, and one starts while the other one listens patiently for the entire bit of content to come out. And then can ask a follow-up question, because those are the rules of the game. I can ask a follow-up. What did you mean when you said, are you suggesting that? And then the person can say, no, let me clarify, right? Mm-hmm. And then there could be a response to that opening comment from mm-hmm. the other party. And then that other party also would have to give the same graciousness back and say, you're allowed to ask me questions too, and I should answer them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so much of it's just about sort of law and order in our streets, and law and order in our conversations, law and order in the way that we approach each other as we try to get a society that works for as many people as possible. And I feel that we've sort of lost that. And it's been kind of a winner-take-all attitude for a long time, not a short time. You know, when we look around, and liberal progressives like myself, I guess I would call myself that, you look around and you find that everything is broken. The healthcare system is broken. Our environmental crisis is only worsening. We have a problem with labor in this country. We're racing to the bottom, and people's wages are getting behind. We have deaths of despair at an ever-increasing rate. We have too much money in politics. The wrong people are controlling the government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I haven't even talked about military spending. I haven't talked about nuclear warfare and devastation. I haven't talked about international affairs. But it just feels like when you look around, you find so many things are just wrong. And the only way that you can feel that way is if there's been a concerted effort to change the environment that we live in for at least a generation and a half. That's how I feel. That's the America that I feel I live in. There's been a continual upending of the old gentleman's agreement, and I would say that it's coming largely from the ultra-right wing that believes in protecting its interests at all costs, that is basically putting us in a race to the bottom, because the elites, who are the ones Bernie's always inveighing against, the elites are largely immunized from the day-to-day realities of normal life that most people whose lives they're affecting by hoarding wealth and power, you know, they don't feel the brunt of those difficulties, because they live in a separate world. They live in their right. enclaves.
So that's an interesting thing to tie into the, you know, the news of the day as we're recording is the first known coronavirus death in the United States. So if we do have the virus spread in the United States, and we reach a point where it's becoming a broad threat, we may reach a point where the elites in society recognize that our health is really only as secure as the least well insured and least well cared for amongst us. Mm-hmm. And if people are living in fear that they can't go to the hospital to get screened for coronavirus because they can't afford what could be a bill of $3,000 was reported in one of the first cases of someone to do that. How does that have the capacity to start really shifting thinking and paradigms?
I don't know. I guess that's how callous do you think the elites are? I'd say pretty callous.
What I'm getting at, though, is if we have an epidemic or pandemic, whatever you want to call it, with coronavirus, mm-hmm. it's going to come perhaps largely because of many people lacking health insurance or good enough health insurance to cover the cost of preventative screening.
Yeah, we have more vulnerable people.
When it comes to disease, disease doesn't give a damn if you have money or if you have insurance. So that kind of breaks down the insulation that the wealthy have in the United States, because the spread, the containment of disease depends on the least well cared for amongst us.
Well, and if it's a global pandemic, then it would, and if it continues and if it worsens, I'm not sure there's an indication that it's going to, but if it starts to disrupt supply chains, and you think about Microsoft, Amazon, and you think about the corporations that have a lot of their manufacturing overseas, and if they're no longer able to deliver product, then there's going to be a lot of people who are going to have less money to purchase things, right? There's fewer people working, fewer products on the market. And that's going to have a ripple effect across the economy, too. So I feel like that is also a broad threat of some sort of a pandemic, is that, yeah, in that case, everybody will be hurt, top, middle, and bottom. But it's a horrible way for change to occur, right?
It would be. It's one of the interesting things to consider is what would be the impact on the world and the way people think if that did happen.
It'd be much better to have MSNBC commentators talking about the need for universal health care so that we can, you know, forestall and prevent pandemics, right? And if they could be advocating for, you know, at least an opening up of that issue to a broader and more detailed discussion, so that people can really see how it might work. You know, again, back to the gentleman's agreement about how do we conduct our affairs. Trying to bring some of these strands of the conversation together now that we're getting close to wrapping up. We like to talk about ways in which average folks, how they can be effective in their own communities in trying to sort of instigate conversations that are productive of positive changes and having an influence on the way that things are talked about, the level of knowledge, the level of detail that people are able to bring to a conversation as important as, say, healthcare or the climate crisis. And so I guess to do that, I would suggest that every person does have a certain amount of influence on every other person. So if you're living in Southwest Montana, you can write letters to the editor in which you lay out thoughtful proposals or thoughtful bits of support for policies that you think would be helpful to society as a whole. We're never going to take down MSNBC or Fox News because they're too potent. But when it comes to influencing each other in our own communities and in trying to get the conversations to a level that's actually meaningful and useful, and perhaps even influential in a positive way, we can do that.
You know, one of the key things that we get from having personal conversations, community conversations, is nuance. You know, which seems to be the enemy of what we digest or consume from the media. That in reality, there are very few people who are ardently on one side of the political spectrum or another. That most of us are aware that, you know, every day we live our lives, for example, with multiple elements of socialism and multiple elements of capitalism. We're using socialism for the roads that we're driving on, and we're using capitalism for the bicycle that we bought to travel on the road, or the car we bought. And that often is lost in the debates that we're seeing, we were talking about politically. It's still, when we look at our own lives, I know I tend to be overwhelmingly interacting with people who are fairly close to me ideologically. Maybe it's a little different for you being up at the university, but do you have some ideas on how to, on an ongoing basis, seek out people who have disparate views, but whom you can have an intelligent and an enjoyable conversation with about political topics?
I think that we could have those conversations every day if we had a mind to. But people tend to be apolitical because it's safe, and we want to be pleasant. And it's like when we were kids, we were taught never start a conversation about politics or religion at the dinner table if you want it to be a nice evening.
I never got that lesson.
I did. I did. That was the one that I graduated to after children are to be seen and not heard. But I think it's far more important for me to understand why a person believes in a certain idea, political orthodoxy. I'm much more interested in learning about how that helps that person to survive in this world. What is the meaning that is being made? How does that particular political notion or policy fit into the way that this person operates in the world? And I've only been doing this for a little while because it occurred to me in class, actually, because a student was telling me, if I'm talking to somebody and he brings up that, you know, that the earth is only 30,000 years old and it's flat, I'm giving him exactly 30 more seconds of my time. You know why? I just don't have time for that kind of nonsense. And that's when it dawned on me that instead of dismissing people whose views are either absurd or challenging to you, or even obnoxious or noxious, is a good thing is just to ask them more questions. You know, not condescending questions, but just genuine questions of real interest. How did you get to that? You know, that's an interesting notion. When did you first start? Or is there a source for that? You start asking questions that show that you're actually curious in the other person. And suddenly what happens is, even though that person who's, let's say, an ultra-rightist realizes that you're a lefty, that person's like, you know, this lefty was actually kind of curious about me. And that right there, that has as much importance as anything else. Trying to reinstate that sort of gentle person's mode of discourse with each other, I think that's really important, because at this point we've kind of shut down. And that student exemplified it in his comment. I'll give him 30 seconds if he's a flat earther. And shutting down is not going to help anybody. So openness and curiosity about each other's experience, I think that goes a really long way. Might not change anybody's point of view, you know, his ideology, but it might make for more sympathetic fellow citizens.
Right. Have you ever been aware of an event at Montana State University that was geared toward that kind of dialogue?
No, there are clubs that there are clubs that are obviously, you know, there's like the Young Republicans, there's the Democratic Socialists. But they're separate enclaves, and I don't know about many events that really are trying to establish that sort of environment where diversity can be on display.
That's one of the things when you were talking made me curious. Well, what is there a model out there for actually stimulating respectful educational dialogue that we could look at?
Well, typically what's happened at MSU is that there has been, like, I can remember back in 2002, the run-up to the Gulf War, there were numerous forums around town. One of them was held at the Sub Ballroom. It was very well attended. Several hundred people were there. And it was actually it was an atmosphere of politeness, even though there were hawks there and there were doves there, and people were taking their turns going up to the podium, and there was a panel of speakers, and that was a good environment, I thought. So yeah, it definitely can be done. And I also remember back in the day when I was on the Bozeman City Commission, groups of citizens would come down and ask us to adopt non-binding resolutions, basically a statement of support for one issue or another. Could be something sort of bland like night skies, you know. There were people who were really interested in observing planets to their telescopes, but they were losing the ability to do it because of the light pollution, and so they came to ask us to adopt a night sky resolution, or to adopt a living wage resolution, or to adopt a resolution in solidarity with the people of such and such a place. And so that's another way to have a community conversation, is to take it to your local elected officials. Not that they will actually adopt a resolution, but the process of having the conversations about it is worthwhile.
Very good.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, thank you for an interesting conversation about mainstream media and politics and socialism and A socialism and B socialism and C socialism.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you, Steve. I hope this has been an engaging conversation. Well, next show we'll be back to our usual format of having on a guest speaker to join the conversation. You have been listening to The View from Here on KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman. If you'd like to catch any other episodes of The View from Here or other KGVM programming outside of listening live, check it out at kgvm.org.